From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's not often that I will promote a show two or three days in advance of the show, and then a day before the show, but I think this is going to be a hell of a show. Regina Calcaterra's memoir, Etched in Sand, is published by HarperCollins. Obviously, we're going to be talking about that book tonight. Click on the link in the show notes to pick it up from Amazon. It's an inspiring and triumphant coming-of-age story of tenacity and triumph, and I thought I would bring on Regina tonight to talk about it, and I'm really looking forward to the interview. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I truly appreciate it.
Now, before we get into the book, I'm going to take a couple of minutes and have you tell my audience a little bit about yourself. You're an attorney. You've done lots of stuff, but why don't you tell them?
Certainly. I'm an attorney, and I work for the state of New York, and I've worked in the public sector and the private sector for about 25 years, and I've been practicing law, and I've been on television for about 10 years doing political commentating as a hobby while I've been practicing law and working in and out of the private sector. But even though that sounds like a pretty bland existence, it's quite a unique step for accomplishment, because I'm somebody who actually grew up in foster homes and homeless shelters and lived on the streets. And the expectations for anyone with that type of background is that you would end up as a teenage prostitute or teenage pregnant or incarcerated or homeless or even worse. And I basically beat the statistics and beat the odds and ended up putting myself through college and law school and just mainstreamed and now contribute to society like every other person is expected to do as well.
When you talk to young kids, men, women, homeless people, and you talk about beating the odds, you know, taking on the odds, so to speak, you were able to do it. You took down the odds, and now you are where you are. How do you sit down and talk to someone? And we mentioned this off air for a second. A lot of kids coming into the United States now with this open immigration policy. I don't want to debate that, but I want to debate all these kids coming into the States probably will end up in the foster system, on the street, wherever. How do we get them to beat those odds?
Because we start, one of the reasons why I wrote the book, which we'll talk about in a little while, what the details are, but one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because my siblings and I came from less than nothing, and we had no safety net and no resources whatsoever, and we believed in ourselves. And when we have self-determination and perseverance and optimism combined with being here in the United States and the amount of resources that are available for a child who's impoverished, if you believe in yourself and you learn how to harness those resources, you will be able to pull yourself up and out. So if there's any place that you're going to be abandoned or you're going to be homeless or you're going to be abused or are somehow subject to a situation where you don't have control as a child, it's much better that you're dealt that terrible hand here than being dealt that terrible hand somewhere else in the world, because at least here there are enough resources to pull yourself up and out. So somehow we need to get that message to all these kids who are now here in the United States that are going to start going through the foster care system and through to homeless shelters and to group homes as well, that if they believe in themselves, they can pull themselves up and out and will one day be a part of mainstream society. However, for kids, for people like us, like those who are dealt a bad hand, like my siblings and I, and these kids who are also dealt a bad hand, it takes a lot longer to pull yourself up and out. But regardless of the fact that it takes you longer, if you put one foot in front of another, and if every single day you get up and you meet your goal that you have to meet that day, it's going to be a day closer to the light at the end of the tunnel. So you can do it here because we have the resources. You just have to believe in yourself, and that's what we need to start teaching these kids as well, so they're not going to be continuously dependent upon these social service systems, so they will be contributing members of our society.
You're right. The system itself is good. It does what it can, but I want to ask you a little bit about self-confidence. How much is taught, how much is inside of you, or is that a 50-50 split?
Most of my self-confidence came from the kindness of strangers. In my in Itch and Sand, I talk about those adults who were terrible to us and those adults who were kind to us. And this is the second reason why I wrote the book. And we had more people in our lives, and I'll speak for me personally. I had more adults in my life who told me that I was smart, that the only way I was going to pull myself up and out of poverty was through education, that I needed to stay in school, that I was talented, that I was worthy, that I shouldn't expect that I should be a statistic, that I actually should receive a college education. I had more and more adults who would take me into their home, show me what a healthy environment was. I had more of those good touches in my life than I had bad touches. So when it was time for me to make a choice about what path I wanted to go down, did I want to end up being a statistic, what everyone expected me to be, or did I believe that I had better opportunities out there? And because I had more good touches in my life, I had more adults giving me positive reinforcement than I had negative reinforcement, I really started to believe them. And I thought, if all these people said this about me, then this must be true, and I must be smart, and I must remain in school, and maybe I can pull myself up and out. So my self-confidence wasn't innate. My self-confidence was learned, and it was learned by the acts of kindness of strangers. And that is especially because I was a transient child and a transient homeless child that would move around a lot, and I was under the radar screen, and I didn't want anyone really focusing on how it was I was living, nor did my siblings, because we never wanted to get separated. But even in a situation like that, where we lived on the margins of society, we still had enough adults had interaction with us. Even though we were only before them for a moment in time, it was enough positive interactions that they accumulated. And again, like I said, any child in their life is going to make a choice, whether it's someone who comes from a stable home or someone who comes from a challenging environment, but they're going to make a choice about what path they're going to go down. As long as they're exposed to opportunity and optimism and healthy environments and shown what their choices are, they can pick that path too. So my self-confidence is learned, and the self-confidence we can build in these children as well. And even though we don't know where they're going to end up and how they're going to turn out, but for this moment in time when they are before us, which is right now because they're in our system, right, if we start building their self-confidence, we expect that other members of our society are going to continue to do this as these kids move on, just like they did it in my life too. And I grew up in a different era. I grew up in the 60s and 70s and 80s. When kids who were marginalized were very easily marginalized, and it was very easy for us to stay under the radar screen. But now it's not. So people are going to be focusing a lot more on these kids who are actually coming in, giving them more resources, and hopefully giving them more encouragement as well. So I actually think they have a much better opportunity to prevail with the level of exposure that they have now versus the level of exposure that we had when I was younger.
Regina Calcaterra is here talking about her new book, actually not so new, but reissued book, Etched in Sand. Why the title? How did you come up with that?
My siblings and I, my mother was drug and alcohol addicted, and she had five children by five different men who didn't stick around till after we were born. So she had a tough time raising us. I mean, so she would find us a place to live and basically drop us there for weeks or months at a time. And we were these five little kids who had to figure out how it was we were going to survive. And we had to steal food to eat. And we would move from place to place to place. And the older siblings would do their best to make every place that we lived a home, so the younger siblings would not know what it was that we were going through. So we somewhat insulated the younger siblings. So regardless of whether or not we lived in an apartment or a house, which we never stayed for long because we'd be evicted, or we lived outside of or in a car or in the back of a supermarket or in a trailer or homeless or on the streets, whatever our environment was, we try to make it a comfortable environment for our younger siblings, and then something would change suddenly in our life, and that would be destroyed, and that we'd have to go on and move to our next place, and we'd have to rebuild our home again. So we thought, since we grew up in a beach community, which is Suffolk County, Long Island, which is the eastern end of New York, we were constantly spending our time at the beach. Right. And, you know, when you build sandcastles and when you write your name in the sand, they're always knocked down by the water. But we would still go back and build our sandcastles, even though we knew that every single time we built a home, that home would be destroyed. We thought of that as a metaphor for spending our time at the beach as much as we did because of the community that we lived in, and building the homes that we did out of nothing that would constantly be knocked down. So it was as if our existence was etched in sand, but we still would go back and recreate it and not let the elements destroy us.
I love the title. And, you know, when it comes to siblings and family, I have four kids of my own, and you see the group dynamic of a family, of course, yours and others, regardless of the circumstances. Being the middle child, and I'm taking it as the leadership role that you took as the middle child, I don't think you're slighting any of your other siblings, though, but how difficult was that?
The leadership role was something that came over time. It wasn't something that started when I was younger, because I have two older siblings and I have two younger siblings. And my two older sisters were the ones who were the parents for the three of us, for the three younger ones.
Right.
But when you grow up homeless and you grow up in the streets, at a certain point when kids become teenagers and they're growing up in the situation, they leave the home. So when my sisters turned 14 and 15, they left the home. We didn't really have a house, but they left our environment. So they would leave and they would go stay with friends. But up until that point, they were basically the ones taking care of us. But at the age of 11, I ended up then becoming the caretaker for my two younger siblings. So at that point, then I started being the backbone of our family, because my two older sisters would come in and visit the kids. But I was basically the one who was actually raising them. And then that just continued on, because I saw how important it was for all of us to stay in contact, because when you're going through such a difficult time and you're isolated and you're starving and we had to steal food to eat and figure out how it was that we were going to survive, the way that we were able to do it was not because we were focusing on our own challenges. It really was because we were worried about each other and we had to take care of each other. And I found that that is really what kept us together. So I knew, I always felt that we were going to do fine as long as we maintained the connection. And that's what Etched in Sand also describes, my journey through trying to keep my siblings together through various foster homes and other scenarios, because I felt if we didn't stay together, then we were going to be destroyed.
Exactly.
So that's where I stepped in and started becoming the backbone to try to keep us together.
Regina Calcaterra is here talking about the book Etched in Sand. There's a link in the show notes on how you can get it from Amazon, and of course you can go to your other bookstores. This is a special Friday night edition of the Dana Pretzer Show. You know, people laugh at me, Regina, that when I sit down and I watch a show like The Waltons, for example, or an older program with a family dynamic to it, and we'll go away from the book a little bit here right now for a second, but I want to talk to you about media today and the disconnect from family values, so to speak. And I'm not trying to be preachy, I'm just trying to say the way that it is. How much influence does media today have on that family dynamic?
I think the media can have influence if parents allow that to have an influence.
Exactly.
And if the parents restrict it and do their best to try to keep the family together and for everyone to be understanding what their role is and their contributions to that particular family, and to be present in their existence as opposed to be looking down at a screen, they're going to be much more engaged and much more involved in their family. So media can play a role, and it can, and it will take over if a family lets it, but it's up to the parents really to make that decision about how much that they're going to let media get involved.
The your mom, mental illness, addictions, five kids, five different dads, the system. How did the system work with your mother, and how did she work with or against the system?
It was a different system. Again, it was the 60s and 70s and 80s.
Right.
And at that particular time, people who had mental illness really weren't diagnosed, and my mother wasn't diagnosed until much later in life. So she tried to self-medicate through drugs and alcohol. And it was also, again, a different era where people didn't recognize mental illness or did not want to acknowledge mental illness. Families shied away from it. They didn't want anyone to know that they potentially had mental illness in their family. And people who were mentally ill denied it and really didn't receive the proper medication. So it was not something that was recognized by society, not just the system, but just not by society. And there certainly weren't the resources available today that there were. There weren't any resources available back then versus the amount of resources today. So that was a tremendous impediment to my mother healing. And it was also a tremendous impediment into us being a cohesive family as well, because they would see my mother would abandon us from place to place, and they didn't try to provide her help. What they would then do is take these five kids away and put them in five separate foster homes or three separate foster homes, and we were five kids, and they would break us up. And they never looked at the family dynamic as important, that the only way that we were going to survive is if we stayed together. So what happened at that time in the foster care system or anything is if we were abused, people really didn't turn us in that much. But we were also complicit in that process, because we never wanted to let anyone know that we were being abused or we were abandoned or that we were starving, because we knew that we'd be separated and put in foster homes. During that particular era, we had foster parents that were horrible. We had foster parents that were fabulous, but we also had ones that were horrible, because during that time, you really didn't go back and do background checks on people.
Sure.
So bad things happened to us in foster homes. But bad things happened to us at the hands of our mother also. And we realized as a sibling group that we were much better being with our mother than being separated in foster homes, because when we were separated, we weren't able to protect each other. And it was better for us to deal with the devil that we knew and the devil that we didn't know. So for five children for about 10 to 15 years to exist in this environment and live under the radar screen where we didn't let anyone know what was going on, but people really didn't prod too much into what was going on as well, was a fault of the system, but it was also a different era where people looked the other way. They allowed you to hit your child, and they didn't get involved in kids who were abandoned, and there weren't resources really that were available to pull these kids up and out. So that's what the challenge was back then. But now there are so many more resources, and there is a tremendous level of consciousness in this country on what to do when you see a child that's being abused and they get reported, and there are these resources that are available, and they don't take the children right away from the parent. They do try to work with the parent as well. So what we have now is so much different than what we had then. What we had then, it was so easy for kids and for those who are mentally ill to fall through the cracks, where now if you are interested enough in helping yourself, there are enough resources to pull yourself out.
You know, trying to hide it eventually turned to a situation where a beating so bad that you sat down and talked with a social worker, and they talked to you about telling the truth. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. By the age of 11, I was the sole caretaker for my two younger siblings, and that lasted for about 3 years up until I was 14. And while I was taking care of them, and we would live in all these different places, I would have to steal food to eat, and I'd have to figure out ways to feed them and to feed me. And as a result, during this process, I became malnutritioned and was incredibly unhealthy, especially because whatever food I was able to get, I would give to them. And my mother would just leave us for weeks or months at a time. And when I was about to turn 14, we were living in an environment where my mother left for about 3 months, and she came back. And she went to abuse my younger sister, Rosie, who is 6 years younger than me. So at that point, Rosie was about 7 or 8 years old. And she went to beat her up. And I jumped in, and I took the beating instead. But because I was so ill and fragile, the beating took on a completely different glow on my body, where I was always tried to hide it in the past, but I wasn't able to hide it. As a result, social services were called, because obviously people saw what I looked like. And the social worker convinced me to tell her what was going on in her life, because she basically told me that I wasn't going to be able to survive. And if I wasn't able to survive, my siblings weren't going to be able to survive either. So we needed to seek help. But if we sought help and we told her the truth of everything that was happening, she said that I would be able to emancipate myself from my mother, which back then in 1980, a 14-year-old in the state of New York would be able to emancipate themselves from their parent. So she said, if I told her the whole story, she'll take that information, she'll go to a judge, and she'll get me emancipated. But the promise was that if I told her that, if I tell her the truth, I also want to make sure that my mother's rights are taken away from my two younger siblings. So I told her the story. We were put in separate foster homes. My two younger siblings were put in one. I was put in the other. The court granted me emancipation, but while my matter was pending before the court, my mother found out what was happening and took my two younger siblings from the foster home that they were in and basically kidnapped them and brought them across country to Idaho so the state of New York wouldn't have any jurisdiction over her whatsoever. So when I told my story, I told it out of desperation, thinking it was the only way that we were going to survive, that to try to get the system to protect us. The system protected me, but it didn't protect my two younger siblings. So breaking this pact is something that I regretted my entire life.
What about the social worker? Can you blame, in your case or any other case, him or her? You know, the old easy answer is to say they were trying to do their job. You got to live the life to understand the life, some will say. What about your thoughts all these years later about that same social worker?
The one thing when I speak to students of social work and I speak to social workers or anyone who works with children, they ask me for one piece of advice. I tell them, don't break your promises.
Right.
Because these children are constantly, kids who grew up in this situation, constantly are having their promises broken by adults and disappointed by adults. And so if you make a promise to them, keep it. Otherwise, you're giving them more and more reasons to lose faith in themselves and lose faith in the fact that anyone out there will actually ever be able to help them. So she didn't keep her promise, but she was one of many who didn't keep her promise. And that's why I implore that upon anyone who I speak to that works with children, that if you make a promise, keep it.
Yeah, exactly. Regina Kilcutter is here talking about the book Etched in Sand. What about, you know, again, I'll probably say what about 100 times tonight, and excuse me for that, but we've talked about social services. We've talked about that social worker, that system. There's medical professionals, the cop on the beat, to whoever. A different era in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, like you say, compared to today. What about the people? Again, even today we see, you know, unless it affects me, I'm going to turn a blind eye. A lot of good people listen to the show, watch the show, read your book. They do care. But what about the person that sees the family, the kids on the street corner, and how they can help? Or should they just turn the other cheek, as a lot of them do, but we want to encourage them to try and help? What about that?
And they could easily do that. That is, again, the first reason why I wrote the book, is to reach out to kids who are going to grow up in challenging situations, and to tell them that, yes, they were dealt a bad hand, but be grateful that you're dealt that bad hand here, and you can figure it out as long as you believe in yourself. The second reason why I wrote the book is exactly for the population of people that you're referring to, because there are so many ways that we can impact the life of a child in need, and it could be so minor and we don't realize it. Because like I said in my book, I described those who gave me good touches versus bad touches. And there would be times when I was a child who was malnutrition and dirty, and I would play with a peer, and I would want to go home with that child and go play at their house, and the parent would take one look at me and tell their child not to take me home.
Jeez.
And they did it to protect their child.
Right.
Then I would go find another child to befriend, and that parent would look at me and realize something was wrong and make sure that their child took me home. And I would go to this home, and I would get a bath, I would get fed, but most importantly, I learned what a healthy environment was. And by learning what a healthy environment was, it gave me the opportunity to start imagining what my life could be like. And that's what the theme is in my book, is that I had all these moments in time that these strangers had a substantial impact upon my life, even though I was before them momentarily, that it just accumulated. And that's the message in the book, is that you could actually have a substantial impact on children's lives, and you don't need to know how it is it going to turn out, but for that moment in time when they're before you, you can make a difference. And that message in the book has resonated worldwide, because every day I get emails from people across the globe, because they can contact me on my website, which is reginacalcaterra.com, or my Facebook page. They message me, and they tell me the acts of kindness that they have done, that after they read the book, they realized the power that they had. And one woman had read the book and started thinking about what she can actually do, where she doesn't have to interface with a child and let them know that she knows what is going on, but help them in a certain way. So she found a grocer in her community that serves a poor community, and she's been given that grocer money every single week, and has told that grocer, every time a child comes in here that looks really hungry, whether it's a child or a teenager, take my pot of money and pay for their food. And that's what she's doing in her act of kindness. Another act of kindness that kind of grew out of this is I went to speak at a book club, and everyone there had read my book except for one man. And I was talking to them about the role that people can play in the life of a child in need. And at the very end of this book club, he came up when everyone left and was crying. His face was wet, and he was crying. And he said he had to tell me what he has done. And apparently, they lived in a wealthy community, and there was one house in that community where the parents were drug and alcohol addicted, and they had a 16-year-old boy. And this man has a 16-year-old boy, and he has told his son to stay away from that boy. And he said not only has he done that, but everyone else in their community has done that as well. And he said he did not realize what he was actually doing to that child by having his child stay away from him, that he wasn't giving him the opportunity to see what options he had. He wasn't showing him in a healthy environment. He just wasn't being kind to him for that moment in time that the child was before him. And he didn't realize that those simple gestures could make a difference in this kid's life. And instead, he was trying to protect his child, but what he was really doing was hurting that other child. So that is the impact that this book has made, is that it's making people think differently. And in fact, the principal from West Virginia had called me, emailed me, and said that she's a principal in a school in a rural community where a lot of transient homeless kids come through. And she's constantly having discussions with her teachers whether or not these kids are a lost cause, because they come in very quickly and then they move on. So the teachers question whether or not they could actually have an impact, because these kids aren't before them for a long time. And she said after reading my book, she realized that no child is a lost cause, and right. She was going to have all the teachers read the book as well, realizing that they can't control what's going to be the outcome of this child. But when that child is before them for that moment in time, if they could do something to be kind, it matters. It's going to have an impact. The child is going to remember. And then when that child goes to the next community, you're going to have another kind person do the same thing. And what you're doing is you're building their confidence. You're telling them that they're worthwhile. And you're giving them options to think about how it is that they, you're giving them a choice of a different existence as well when you start exposing them to how it is that you live. And that's how people, in very simple ways, can change the life of people who are in need. Just remind them that they're worthy and show them different options out there by simple gestures.
Absolutely. You're listening to a special Friday night edition of the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We're talking to Regina Calcaterra about the book Etched in Sand. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with more with Regina Calcaterra.
The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio will be right back.
Okay, we're back. This is a special Friday night edition of the Dana Pretzer Show. Regina Calcaterra is here. We're talking about the book Etched in Sand. Regina, one of the themes of the book is sibling bonds. And again, it should be self-explanatory, but I want you to talk a little bit about it. How important is it for you to all bond together?
It was extraordinarily important, and it was basically how we survived as kids, our ability to bond and for us to stay together. And it's usually that has a lot to do with resilience, because it's not clear whether or not resilience is something that's learned or something that's genetic. But if you're with others when you're going through traumatic time and you care about those others that you're with, you're not so focused on yourself, you're taking care of each other. And that is what ultimately gets you through. So our level of resilience was maybe part of it was learned, maybe part of it was genetic, but most of it really had to do that we were so focused on pulling our, not letting our siblings fail, that if we kept moving forward, then they were going to keep moving forward as well. If one or two of us failed, then there was a chance that they were going to fail as well. So the bond that we made as these young siblings trying to figure out how it was we were going to survive is basically what kept us alive and kept us moving forward. And that same concept of resilience and resilience in a group applies across the board. If you think about some of the POWs in the Vietnam War,
sure,
who were kept in different, they were kept in different cells, so they were separated out, but they were still close together and they communicated with each other, and that's what kept them alive. That bond that they created is what got them through the experience that they had, and that bond that we had as siblings going through a very, very challenging environment is what pulled us through. So when a foster care system comes in and separates children at a young age, there's a good chance that these kids are going to start failing if they don't have each other. And that ultimately, that started happening because when my youngest sister Rosie was taken from us, and she was the baby because she was so much younger than all of us, and she would be put into a separate foster home because it was more easy to place a child, an infant, she started suffering something called failure to thrive, where she wasn't eating because she wasn't getting the affection that she needed, and she didn't have the level, she didn't have the consistency of love and adoration that we were giving to her when she was in the home. And the social services system realized that the only way that she was going to get better is if she, if they placed her with us again, and that's ultimately what helped with her recovery. So when you, so the bond that these kids make at such a young age is tremendous. It's what kept us alive. It's what's going to keep these children going forward as they move on to the next the next generation. And basically, what we did as a sibling group is we made a decision that what we didn't want in our life, because of how much it destroyed us, is we didn't want drug or alcoholism, we didn't want abuse, and we didn't want homelessness or incarceration, and we didn't want to be, have to be dependent upon the social service system. So within one generation, all of us broke that cycle, and we did it together because we stayed together and we made a commitment that we weren't going to live the life. We didn't want how it was that we were, what the experiences that we had as children to define us as adults. So we were able to break this bond together because we made that commitment together.
Eventually, you will get to the age where you are going to be on your own, 21, and you won't be in the system. You're the middle child. You're the leader, so to speak. The younger ones aren't there. How does that affect everyone staying together, and how difficult was that to deal with?
Well, but by that time, well, first of all, in the United States, the when kids are 18, when children are in the foster care system, and it depends on what state that they're in, at the age of either 18 or 21, they age out of the system. And what that means is that they go on their own, and either they can go to college and try to figure out how it is that their college is going to be paid for, or they can just go out and get themselves an apartment and a job and try to start to live independently as well, which is not a good way to be handling our foster youth, because the reality is that we should be really focusing on getting them a family and getting them parents before they age out, rather than putting them out there on their own. So we aged out of the foster care system without parents, and at that particular time, we had to take care of ourselves because we had to individually propel forward in order to keep the others going. So we had to move forward with our lives. I got myself into college by, thankfully, because I had teachers who were tremendously committed and dedicated to making sure that I was going to get into college. So as I was pushing myself forward through college, my sisters ended up, who were a few years older than me, got married and started building families. So our paths started going down different routes, because the way that I saw how we grew up and the problems that we had is that we didn't have money. And I made a vow to myself that I'm always going to do the best I possibly can to make sure that I'm never going to be impoverished again. And my understanding is that the only way to do that was to get an education. The way that my sister saw how we grew up is that we really didn't have a family. We didn't have parents. We didn't have that structure. So they thought the way that they can somehow address how we grew up when we were younger was to get married and have families. And we were both right, because my one sister, Camille, has been married for 30 years and has raised five amazing kids and is about to be a grandmother. And you know, I went through law, I went to college and I later went to law school. And so I pulled myself up and out through education, and Camille pulled herself up and out by having a family. So even though our courses or our paths ended up being different, we still stayed in each other's lives as we were trying to grow up through our 20s and 30s. And now that we're more established, we can spend more time with each other. But that happens in any situation. It happens with any sibling group. As each child is going through their 20s or 30s, they're trying to find their way in the world, and then they make their way back to their siblings.
How do you as a group decide who your role model will be, whether it's that social worker, that teacher, that whatever? It's got to be difficult because there's got to be a huge lack of trust for, well, pretty much everyone except yourselves.
The we didn't have role models, but we had a lot of faith in ourselves, in each other, and we had such tremendous love for one another that we didn't want to let each other down. So if each one of us, if I succeeded, then they succeeded, and if I failed, they failed. So rather than role models, we just reinforced our existence with one another. But I was able to find role models, but I found role models through books. And what happened when I was younger is my mother would have us registered in school. So from time to time, we'd be able to go to school and we would get a free lunch there. But there were other times she had so many warrants out against her arrest that she didn't want to register us in school because she was afraid the authorities would find us.
Jeez.
So then we would have a lot of time on our hands and we had to figure out how to occupy our minds. So we would spend so much time in libraries. And it was fabulous because, I mean, even libraries today, these kids who are impoverished could go into a library and could spend 8 to 10 hours there sitting in the corner reading a book, and no one's going to bother them. And that's what we did. So it was when I started spending time in libraries and reading and then also teaching my younger siblings to read that I started reading books and started getting my role models through books. And one of my role models at a very young age was a variety of different women that were historic women, and I saw how incredibly gutsy they were, and that they were going through, that they lived in a different era when women were not supposed to succeed, but they were still succeeding, and they weren't letting the situation that they were born into define them, or the era that they were born into limit them. And through reading about a variety of different historic women, I started getting my role models of the women that I wanted to emulate, and it was literally through books. So even though we didn't have individuals who were role models, through reading, I was at least able to build those role models in, and that helped me put together my personal code to figure out what it was that was acceptable in my life and what was not acceptable in my life. And it was through reading and through books and through libraries and through teachers.
Regina Calcaterra is here talking about Etched in Sand. Let's talk about, and I hate talking about government, but let's talk about government. Let's talk about the lawmakers. Again, you mentioned state to state, North America, country to country. The laws are different. You know, we can all agree we're here to protect the children. We can all agree that there are some problems with the system. But what about the lawmakers themselves? What message do you put in your book to them?
That they have a tremendous role. What I learned at the age of 19 when I was putting myself through college was that politics politics has such an impact on all of us. And I learned at the age of 19, I was taking this class on international politics accidentally. And I'm saying that because I can't imagine any 19-year-old actually signs up for a class in international politics. So I accidentally signed up for it. But what I learned as I was sitting in this class is that what was happening to families that were lived in Haiti and in the Middle East and in Africa at that time. And I realized the power of what we have here in the States. And I also learned the definition of politics. And the true definition of politics is the allocation of resources. And that basically means that whoever is in charge gets to allocate the resources. So our government leaders are the ones making the decisions about allocating the resources. So learning at such a young age about what their role was is what inspired me to start going into, like, thinking about the law and going into public service, because one day I want to be in a position to determine to be the one to help allocate the resources, because I understand what it means when there are these simple cuts. Because what happens when there are cuts in budgets, whether it's on a county level or a state level or federal level, is sometimes it's the most vulnerable population that we have is the one that actually bears the burden, because they are the one that is voiceless. So the message to the lawmakers in this is, in Etched in Sand, is to show them that the impact that they actually have by one decision that they make, by taking away one resource, can have a detrimental effect on the lives of these children.
Okay, we talked about government. Now we're going to talk about that social worker, that cop on the beat, that that paramedic, that Joe Public who sees that kid or those group of children that are together, or that family, and you wonder if they're living in the backseat of their car or in the shelter at the baseball diamond. What's the message to them?
Is to intercede, regardless of what they think, what their fear is going to be. They have to intercede, especially if they see children in need, because there were so many people in my life that did not get involved, and what it did is it disempowered us. When we realized that people weren't interested in helping us, then it weakened us, and it gave us little ability to fight back, because we didn't think anyone was ever going to be there to protect us. If you see that there's a child in need or a family in need, get involved, step up, ask them what services they need, if there's a way that you can help them. If there's a child being abused, quickly report it, and you have to report abuse as much as you see it, because there may be a case of abuse that was reported against a child one time that may not have been taken seriously, but that if that report is made again against the child, it may result in a case being opened and an investigation happen. So if you see that there's any opportunity that you need to get involved, you have to get involved, because what you're ultimately doing is telling that family or telling that child that they matter and that they're worth it.
New York Times bestseller, Etched in Sand. You're busy. You're an attorney. You're working. I've looked at your website. The link is in the show notes, people. Pick up the book. I've got goosebumps tonight listening to this lady talk, because this is real life, ladies and gentlemen. This isn't phony Hollywood mumbo-jumbo. This is how it happens. People like to hear the rest of the story. So why don't we finish up the next 15 minutes and talk about your family and the rest of the story, and will there be another book?
Absolutely. When we were, so what happened when I was younger, I had mentioned it earlier in the story, is that when I went to emancipate myself, my siblings and I were put into separate foster homes. So I stayed in one home, they were put in another home, and my younger siblings, their names are Rosie and Norman. My mother took them and kidnapped them and brought them across country. And what I then did, and what my older sisters did for many years, is try to have the state of New York communicate with the state of Idaho to let Idaho know that my mother was a danger to my younger siblings. And the two states refused to talk. The state of New York said, these kids are out of our care, we have no responsibility for them anymore. And the state of Idaho was not interested in what the state of New York had to say. So we were these kids who were... I was living in foster care. My younger sisters were my older sisters were on their own at that time, and nobody was paying attention to us. But while this was happening, we still had to move forward with our lives. And I managed to put myself through college, as I had explained earlier. And then I just moved on in my life and did my best to mainstream. And when I started working, the one thing I never wanted to do was get involved in social services whatsoever, because I was tremendously cynical about that. So my entire profession, I have stayed away from that. And my sisters went on to raise their older their families. But while this was happening, we were still trying to do our best to protect our younger sibling back in Idaho. So one part of the story actually shares with the reader the extent that we went to try to get my younger sister from Idaho to New York, which involves a few wigs and a plane ride, which is quite interesting once you get to that point. But it actually shows the extremes that we had to go to try to protect her, but we still failed. So the story will take you upon this journey of how we're all pulling ourselves up and out individually, and how we're trying to keep our family together, even though we're separated now across the continent. And another theme of the story is that we had five different dads. I always wanted to know who my father was, And that in the book, in Netcha Sand, the readers will learn that I was treated differently and the level of abuse I was subjected to was a little bit different because of who my father was. So I always wondered who this man was. And when I finally tracked him down, I wanted him to take a DNA test, not because I wanted anything from him, but just because I wanted to know. I felt like I have a right to know who my father is. So towards the end of the book, you actually learn that I brought a case against him that was a groundbreaking case here in the United States, where went up to the Supreme Court in the state of Washington, where it showed that a child has a right to know who their parentage is. And so that set precedent in that particular state. A few other states have also adopted similar statutes as well. So the book takes you through the journey of this ragtag group of kids who are living on the fringe of society and then ultimately get separated, and then how we pull ourselves up and out as adults, and then how later on in our life we all get back together again. So it ends very nicely where we were able to form a relationship again with my younger siblings. And it also takes the reader through my professional life. That's more of a side story, because the main story is the struggle of these siblings.
You know, maybe a side story to you, but I think it's part of the main story. It's you were able to have that confidence that to work through what you work through. Some will say you've been to hell and back, but your family was able to, you and your brothers and sisters were able to stick together, beat the odds, beat the system, so to speak. And I guess in the last few minutes here, Regina Calcaterra is here talking about the New York Times bestseller Etched in Sand. When you look at the next story or the next topic in your life now, whatever it will be, we turn on the TV and we see planes being shot out of the air. We see, as we talked a little bit at the start of the show, the immigration issue where all these kids are flooding into the United States and other places, and we worry about them. And you grew up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and so did I. And now we're 2014, and tomorrow could be another story, another disaster. How do you, as a survivor, maybe you like that term, maybe you don't like that term, I'm going to use the term conqueror because you were able to beat the odds, how do you look at that next story, and what might that next story be for you to put on the page?
Well, the next book that I'm the present book that I'm working on right now is Rosie's story, because my younger sister was taken from us by my mother and brought across country, and we had very little contact with her, and she had a very challenging upbringing as well, and she wasn't with us, so she ended up being isolated. So I'm working with her on sharing the story of how it is that she survived. But while that story is being developed, I'm doing what I have been doing all along, is instead of trying to address large scenarios like Ukraine shooting down a Malaysian air flight or these a substantial amount of kids who are coming in from another country, I try to find an issue that's very important to me that I could focus on, that I know that I can contribute to. Like I said, it's my own small act of kindness. And the one issue that is incredibly important to me is kids who are in foster care.
Right.
Because here in the United States, we have over 400,000 children in foster care.
Jeez.
And every year, 10% of them age out to nobody but themselves. So there are over 40,000 kids every single year that are ages 18 to 21 years old that age out of the system and are basically given the equivalent of a one-way bus pass and the address of the closest homeless shelter, and they're kicked out on their own. And it's these kids who end up incarcerated or end up homeless. And people don't adopt them when they're teenagers because they think that they're unadoptable, because they think that they're bad kids. But the reality is that they're not bad kids, but they had bad parents. So my way of paying it forward, and I've been doing this for years, is working with an organization called You Gotta Believe, where we work to get older foster kids adopted. And by getting one older foster child adopted, you're changing their life, and you're changing the generations that are going to follow, because if you have somebody adopt these kids when they're teenagers and prevent them from being homeless at the age of 18 and give them a safety net for the rest of their life, they're going to learn a healthy environment, and then when they get older and they have children, they're going to be living in a stable environment, and you're ultimately helping the next generation as well. So rather than dealing with the much larger complex problems, which I'll leave that to our national leaders, I try to find and work on one child at a time through this organization. And literally almost on the past few weeks, on a weekly basis, we have been able to get a young adult adopted on a weekly basis. So we know that we're changing generations because of that.
It's fantastic. Some of the email comments that are coming in, that this is fascinating. It's an excellent interview. It's a fantastic book. It's Etched in Sand, New York Times bestseller, Regina Calcaterra. Thank you. A thousand thank yous. I really appreciate your time. I hope you enjoyed your time on the program here. And for those listening, click on the link in the show notes. It's a must-buy. Read the book. Pay it forward. Help the kid. That act of kindness is a wonderful thing. It's something that's remembered. Thank you, ma'am. I really appreciate it.
And thank you so much for your time as well.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Regina Calcaterra. The book, Etched in Sand, a New York Times bestseller. Click on the link in the show notes to learn more. And again, this is a rarity for me to do a Friday night show, but I thought how important a topic for all the kids. 400,000, imagine, in foster care, and her struggle to keep her family together. It's one that can't be beat. And what a fascinating story. Etched in Sand, New York Times bestseller. Click on the link in the show notes. Again, thank you to Regina Calcaterra, the author. Thank you to those who suggested that I bring her on the show, because without those suggestions, I may not have known to bring her on the show. And what a fantastic interview. I had goosebumps listening to this gal talk. It's kind of a been there, done that situation. That's it. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. We'll see you again real soon here on the Dane Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.